Hello and welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the president of TuneCore Publishing, Jamie Purpura. But the first thing I want to talk about is four reasons why tech seems to be beating music in attracting the young and smart of the world. First thing is there's not as much glamour in music as there used to be. Music was a draw because, well, yeah, if you're a guy, you'd meet girls. And if you're a girl, you'd meet more guys. That's true. And it's true today as it was any other time in history. But there's a whole lot less glamour in the business. And one of the reasons why is there's actually more glamour in the tech business. You read about it every day in the paper. You read about a new IPO that happens with the tech company. You read about some new software that's coming out, a new app, a new iPhone app. It's all over. While you hardly ever read about a music happening, not like the way you used to. And because of that lack of glamour, that lack of media visibility, there's a lot less people that are coming into the business. There's people that normally used to now go into tech. So that's one of the reasons. The second one is you can actually make a lot more money in tech than you can in music. And once upon a time, sort of the American dream was to be a rock musician, to be a rock star. You could do it. You can make not only a living, you can make some pretty good money. And if the cards fell right, well, you can be a star or a superstar. Well, you can still be a star or a superstar today, and probably your chances are just about the same as they've ever been, which is pretty small. But the fact of the matter is it's a lot harder to make a living these days than it used to be in the music business. It used to be that if you wanted to play six nights a week in clubs to make a reasonable living, there was the opportunity to do that. And that's no longer the case. There are fewer and fewer gigs, which, first of all, enabled you to learn your craft, but second of all, really gave you the money that you needed to learn your craft. And that's pretty much gone away these days. So that's another reason why people go into tech. Into tech, you can, if you have any kind of programming skills, you can immediately make money and you can immediately make a fairly good living. And not only that, the possibility of the same amount of glamour, if not more, is available. The third thing is there's a lot more freedom in tech than there really is in music these days. Once upon a time, the more experimental you were, the more people liked it. And there's less of that these days. The more experimental and off the beaten track you are, the less likely you are to draw an audience. Now, you will draw an audience no matter what. There's always somebody out there that will like what you're doing. But once upon a time, to be different was celebrated. And that's no longer the case. The way it goes now is if you're different, you're somewhat outcast. Where what happens in tech, you're encouraged to do something new. That encouragement is something that, especially when you're young, you really want. You really want to do your own thing. You really want to be different. You don't want to stick with the crowd. Or if you do want to stick with the crowd, it's possible that, in fact, you can take your own little left turn and you can make money with it, which is much more difficult to do in the music business these days. And the fourth thing is that tech is somewhat more creative than music is, at least right now. When you're young, the one thing you want to do, if you have a creative bone in your body, is you want to exercise that. You really want to be creative. You want to get out and you want to do your own thing. And that was one of the big attractive things to music for a long, long time. The fact of the matter is, you can actually exercise that creative bone a lot easier in the tech business than you can in the music business these days. The other thing that you have is, for better or for worse, record labels and publishers are actually run more like large corporations these days than they used to be. It used to be very, very loose, a very loose environment where you felt really good about what you're doing, especially when you're young. That's important. You don't want to conform. You don't want it to seem like a job. And music was really perfect for that. And now tech is the same way. And you find if you get a job in a publishing company or in a record label, it's a lot more straight-laced and a lot more corporate than it ever has been. So you put all those things together and you find that tech is a draw for the brightest people that we have that normally would go into music. And it's one of the things that really scares a lot of us, is the fact that there's a whole generation of wonderful music that none of us are going to hear because some of the people that might have given it to us are writing apps instead. Second thing I want to talk about is Guitar Center, our old friend. And Guitar Center is being sued for unfair labor practices. As you well know, one of the problems with Guitar Centers is that the people that work there turn over frequently. And a lot of it is because they really don't want a job to begin with. If they have to get a job, at least they want it to be around music. So they're not terribly serious about it to begin with. That's the first thing. Second thing is, though, that if you get a job there, you get worked really hard. And you don't get a lot back for it, and you don't get a lot of benefits. And as a result, four stores last year voted to actually join the union. And they joined the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, which is the RWDSU. There are two other stores that actually voted the union down, but four stores voted for it. And these are in New York City, Chicago, and Las Vegas. The big problem happened when Guitar Center really never seriously entered into talks about how to implement the union, how to implement benefits, all the things that a union contract would supply to the workers. As a result, the bargaining talks were stalled. Everyone felt that it was an attempt to punish the workers who voted for the union representation. So as a result, the AFL-CIO actually filed suit against Guitar Center, and they're trying to force them into these negotiations. Well, lo and behold, I was talking to a friend of mine that works at Guitar Center, and he's just kind of on the floor. He's not a manager, although I do know managers. I do know people that are execs over there. But I like to talk to the people that are on the floor. And it turns out that Guitar Center is beginning to implement a whole new set of not so much benefits, but a new working structure, which is more based around a salary rather than a commission. And as far as the workers are concerned, that's probably a good thing. They like it. They like being more secure rather than having to be forced to sell things. But when you're under the gun of a quota that you have to meet every month, that puts a lot of pressure on you. So it looks like voting in a union is actually a good thing for Guitar Center. I think it's a good thing for all of us, actually, because one of the things that we want is we want pros to help us when we go and purchase music gear. We want their opinion. We want their opinion to be something that we can trust. We want to always see the same salesperson if we can. So this can only be helpful if, in fact, it helps the service there. And I think any improvement will. So that's a really good thing. And I applaud Guitar Center for that, if, in fact, that's really happening. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle. My guest today is Jamie Porpora, and he spent 17 years at Bug Music, which was one of the biggest indie publishers in the world, but now he's the president of TuneCore Music Publishing. And actually, I spoke to him on location in his office in Burbank, which is kind of unusual because we usually do these via Skype, but literally, Jamie was right down the street. He's less than a mile from where I am. So I figured I'd go to his office and talk to him face to face.
So, Jamie, thanks for being on my podcast. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome.
How is TuneCore different from when you were at Bug?
Bug was... To be signed up at Bug, we took anyone, but at the time when it was being built up and developed, not every artist could just distribute their sound recordings through iTunes. As you know, that didn't happen until like 2003 or so. So Bug, we had a lot of independent writers, And we had a lot of big riders. We had Willie Dixon and Muddy Waters and Stevie Ray Vaughan's estate and Johnny Cash and Pete Townsend and the Guess Who and on and on and on. So it was higher level things. And one of the things that bothered me there is when I saw the iTunes thing happen and I saw the independent, the distribution entities make it available for independent artists, one of the things I wanted to do there and wasn't able to do was to make the publishing administration platform available for everyone, not just if you had cuts on a release that was on a major label, not just if you were a writer that was in a, you know, higher profile act, because that the royalties for that separate copyright were sitting everywhere. They were sitting at digital providers like Rhapsody back then, or at, you know, at the societies that iTunes would pay the separate copyright for the publishing for the composition, and it would just sit. So those doors those doors opened and the record store shelves became endless. But that second copyright was only represented for the higher level copyrights, the higher level composition.
Well, did you start TuneCore Publishing then?
Yes.
You were brought in specifically to do that.
Specifically to build this office and this platform and this division of it.
Yeah.
And then the point was to make this available for all the TuneCore customers that distribute.
Of which there's...
A ton of them, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of perfect. What exactly are you administrating? Or you're administrating just the mechanicals then, right?
No. Anything to do with the copyright that's a composition. So any sound record, anything you hear on the radio, buy on iTunes, buy a record, buy an 8-track, buy a CD, press the streaming button interactively, there's two copyrights involved, one for the sound recording and one for the composition.
Right.
So I always use the Frank Sinatra My Way example. If it's the Sinatra version, clearly Reprise Records owns the sound recording. If it's the Elvis Presley version, RCA owns the sound recording.
Yeah, sure.
But either time, Paul Anka owns, and his publisher owned the composition.
Yeah.
So there's two separate copyrights there. So you got the Circle P, which is phonograph, for the sound recording, Circle C for the composition.
Right.
So that they're completely two separate things. Mm-hmm. There's a completely different way to receive the revenue from one versus the other. The composition has more revenue streams, which is why you see publishing entities going for hundreds of millions of dollars, especially if they have large amounts of ownership. If they've bought the compositions from the songwriters or represent large ones.
When someone signs up with you, do you go and look for money retroactively?
In a lot of cases, yes.
Yeah.
It depends on the territory that the revenue's at. If you do a spot, if somebody signs up and there's Spotify streams, it'll go back to the beginning of the store. Same thing with Rhapsody. A lot of societies in Europe, they'll go back if we push them real hard, but it depends who it is, what it is, and it depends which territory it's in. But that's not, you know, just to go through your previous question, there's the mechanicals from streaming, download, physical sales, and we also, if you have TuneCore releases, but you also, your song was covered by somebody on a label, we go after the label for the money. But then there's performance, which is the radio, television. There's the synchronization licensing. We have in-house negotiators for that. If somebody wants to use your song for film, television, etc. And there's also print. There's also ringtone royalties.
Yeah.
There's a ringtone performance in Europe.
Is there still a business there?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. There's still royalties collected for that.
Is it more in Europe than it is here?
Yeah, and actually in Europe there's a ringtone performance royalty.
Oh.
Another difference in Europe, for here, you get a mechanical royalty for a download like on iTunes or Amazon. In Europe there's a performance royalty for the download as well.
Wow.
So it breaks up and it breaks down and it is different in a lot of different places. And it's very complicated to get it all in.
Is there a particular territory that's easier or more difficult to get money out of? Outside the U.S.
Outside of the U.S., Canada is a dream.
Yeah.
They tend to go retroactively on everything.
Yeah.
Even iTunes downloads, mm-hmm. because it is deducted there and paid. After that, it would just trail off, and it could get really nasty in some parts of Europe.
And Asia, is it?
That's very difficult. Yeah, Jazzrak with Japan, very difficult.
And China's impossible, I guess, right?
Well, and you wouldn't have that copyright's not protected in communist government. So it's there is no intellectual property law there because it's communist. Same thing with Cuba or, you know, North Korea. You're not going to get anything.
So you also cover sync rights then?
Yes.
As well. But you didn't start out administrating sync rights as well, right?
We left it as an optional thing in the beginning. I switched that because songwriters were bypassing us to negotiate a synchronization fee and taking a lower fee.
Yeah.
They would take a $500 fee or a $1,000 fee, thinking they were cutting us out of our 10% commission of $50 or $100, not realizing that we would have got them $3,000 or $4,000 for the fee. So they ended up losing a couple grand.
Yeah.
This is a synchronization license is something where you need to let the experts handle it. It's not something that, as a band, you go, okay, well, this seems like this is worth this. How do you know?
Yeah, right.
It could be a big commercial. We just did a huge commercial for Manchester United with Chevy involved that, you know, ended up being very, very, you know, six figures. And the songwriters themselves would not have known what to do.
Yeah, I'm sure. Or even had the ability to go get it.
They would have got taken to the bank and wouldn't have known any different.
Yeah. So what's the advantage of TuneCore Publishing over a normal publisher, besides the fact that it's convenient if you're a TuneCore artist already to have TuneCore?
Well, one advantage is we are more, we built this from scratch with these new mediums in line. So in other words, me and my staff have the experience of 20 years, 20 years from me, a few others, 10, 15 years of the old school way, which is the licenses for mechanicals, any record label money, how to get that. And obviously we know we lived through the transition of registering the songs electronically. And our whole platform was built that way. When I started in this in the 90s, we were doing hand forms to BMI or ASCAP or CSAC or overseas.
Yeah.
Or sending a printout to a entity overseas to help us collect it. Now we dump the file straight in. But the big advantage to the TuneCore customer, if you distribute, is that we have all the data, the ISRC code, the UPC, all those things. Where the bigger publishers, if the song's on a label separately and then the publisher's separate, they don't always share that information or have it, so it's a lot more difficult for them to crack that money loose.
What happens if there's a TuneCore artist that suddenly gets an offer from a major publisher, or the publishing is part of a deal for with a major label or something? What happens?
There's usually an out negotiated. They contact us. Our deal's yearly. So it's really a matter of, okay, our deal, it just auto-renews unless we're notified 60 days prior.
Mm-hmm.
The reason it has to be a yearly deal is we do all this work up front to try to get this money loosened to you.
Yeah.
And if we let you out of it a month into it or 2 weeks into it, or 6 months into it, a lot of times overseas, it takes a year and a half for the revenue to show up.
Well, that's my next question then. When do the statements come for a songwriter?
It depends on the source and it depends on the territory. A streaming source in the U.S. would be a monthly accountings we get. BMI, ASCAP, CSAC, quarterly accountings. We get monthly accountings from a few things in Europe, but mostly it's quarterly, and in some cases every 6 months.
So the artist gets a statement every...
Well, from us, they get one every quarter,
okay.
45 days after, which most publishers are 3 months every quarter with 60 days after, and a lot of them are every 6 months and 90 days
after.
We're looking at possibly next year moving to monthly. And 30 days after.
Well, that'd be nice. And does the artist, the songwriter, have access to the data that you have then?
Yeah, what we do is the deal's also scheduled. So it's not a catalog deal for everything you write. It's only the compositions you submit.
Mm-hmm.
So if you distribute them through TuneCore, they come up on a dashboard and you select, these are the songs that I have publishing on. Here's the percentage that I claim. And we register those for you. So only those compositions are locked into the agreement.
Mm-hmm.
If you have stuff on releases on labels or outside, there's an outside form we have you send in and we go after that.
What is the conversion ratio, so to speak, of artists that are signed to TuneCore that use TuneCore Publishing?
Probably about 25%.
Really?
So far, yeah.
And did it start like that, or has this been building up? Is this something that artists kind of realize they need or want? Or
It's been a slow, steady thing. 500 to 600 or more songwriters a month.
Yeah.
Signing up. And we alert them in different ways, and we explain it to them in different ways. And as you've probably already ascertained, it's very complicated stuff.
Sure. Yeah.
But we did it in a fair way to where you're being, accounted to quarterly. You got it every year. You got an opt-out window. How they were notified was your other question. You know, that's where they select their songs, right? But we also show them the status. So if we sent the songs for the compositions for registration, if they came back, then you see registered. They submit it, then they show that we sent them, and then they show registered. If there's any issues, we reach out and we work those things out.
So if an artist decides they don't want to be involved any longer, they have to let you know 60 days in advance before the end of
the year term on the anniversary date
on the song.
Yeah,
got it. No, that makes sense. And what is it, via email? Is it
just something, something they sign in writing?
Oh, okay, yeah. What would you recommend for a songwriter? And most neophyte songwriters are naive to publishing. How would you recommend they learn more about what they need to know? Is there something that's available on TuneCore website?
Yes, we have a frequently asked questions section that I've let up as many industry secrets out as I could.
Yeah. I've read some of them.
And it's very thorough and it's very informative. And we, where these revenues come from. I mean, it's a different thing. It's very, people like to think in terms of how many CDs were sold and how many cents per each one. That was the simple days,
the
right?
Original point. Yeah.
Now you've got streaming that's interactive and non-interactive. You get a streaming mechanical on the interactive. You don't on the non-interactive.
Yeah.
Like a Pandora, you just pick your channel, you just get a performance royalty.
Yeah.
There's no mechanical royalty there. But on a download or a stream like Spotify, there is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
On a YouTube play, there is, because it's interactive and it's really a sync fee. It just, generates on the amount of plays and what type of advertisement's on there.
Yeah.
And you can't really give anybody a formula because it depends on what the ads are.
Yeah,
and if they're just a pop-up in the corner, if there's a full commercial before it, if there's another pop-up on a section of the screen. Same thing with the Spotify streams. It depends on their subscriptions and the advertising revenue.
Yeah.
And there's three formulas, and the greater of the three formulas wins. And the rate constantly changes.
And, it's funny because you look at the number of people that are complaining that, I had 2 million streams on Spotify and I only made $30, but they don't understand where all the money is going and how much is collected. It may not be as much as everybody thinks, or it may be more and they're just not seeing it.
I think the issue is there's multiple royalties. There's three royalties there. There's the sound recording royalty, which you get as you own the master recording, and say you put it through TuneCore and you made it available on Spotify, so you're getting that.
Yeah.
Then there's a performance royalty from the CO, from the society, if you are affiliated at BMI ASCAP CSAC, which we help you do if you're not. And then there's the streaming mechanical. So you add all those together, it's a multi-type of revenue thing.
Yeah.
There's three pieces of revenue off that one clicking the button to stream it.
Yeah.
Not just one. And everybody's trying to simplify it to that one. You buy the album and there's the 9 cents per song.
Yeah.
And all these other things up may not add up to 9 cents, but they're starting to.
Yeah.
And you have to grab all the pieces. Remember, you buy the record at the store, the performance royalty isn't there. There's no BMI, ASCAP, or CSAC royalty there.
Right.
And that's the other misconception. They think that if they're affiliated with ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC, they're getting all their money. That's not true. You're getting the performance on a stream. You're getting a performance on a YouTube play. You're getting radio and TV and performance. You're getting no mechanicals at all. You're not getting any mechanicals for a record sale or a download or an interactive stream. Or print.
Or print, yeah, right.
And there's a lot more digital print out there than everybody realizes.
Is there really?
Yeah. There's a few entities where we send the full catalog, and you'd be surprised. Everybody laughed at me.
Okay.
And then here come the checks. Things like a Touch Tunes jukebox. Everybody thinks jukebox is just the performance from ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC. Truth is, it's interactive. There's a mechanical do.
Ah.
Because the song was interactively selected, and it's a digital jukebox. There's a lot of money popping up there.
You know, the only thing that's interesting is someone will say, well, I had 3 million streams, and I only made X dollars. But in the grand scheme of things, 3 million streams anymore isn't all that much. I mean, it's just kind of the barrier to entry. You know, it's the same thing with YouTube, for instance.
Well, you start getting into 3 million streams on a Spotify or a Rhapsody, there's money there.
I'm saying there's money there.
Yeah. If you're talking about 3 million streams on a YouTube video, it just depends on what's attached to it and what else that's linked to. As you know, the internet links everything together,
yeah.
Whether it's a Facebook page or YouTube or whatever. And all those linking things and that whole web it creates, you can't look at that YouTube thing as the revenue just off of that particular platform. Yeah. It's the reciprocal effect of it on everything else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that YouTube video might have caused you a lot more Spotify streams. It might have caused you a lot more Apple iTunes downloads. It might have caused several things that generate more revenue. It also may have caused a film or TV supervisor to be interested in using your song for something.
Right. Well, do you guys actually pitch Music Soups then?
We have two in-house creatives that we are pitching relentlessly 5 days a week at all film and TV productions here, which is why we could have started this in Brooklyn, but I wanted to do it here in Burbank because you look out the window, yeah. There's Warner Brothers, there's Universal, there's NBC, CBS, ABC, Disney. Fox is right over the hill. We're right in the middle of everything. And we wanted to be in the middle of all that to, you know, we're here, we're down the street, you know.
How do you decide what to pitch?
It's really about what they're looking for. So, you know, we're doing this and we're actively doing it, and we really look at the sales data on the TuneCore side. So if we also have pub admin on these songs, we see who's getting hot. We highlight a lot of those if they're starting to kick up. But, you know, if they're looking for heavy metal for a video game and you play country western, I'm not going to send the country western to
them. Right.
And vice versa. But it's they're very selective. They send out what they're looking for to us.
Yeah.
We have those contacts, we have those relationships. They're looking for something like this in, you know, background in a bar. Mm-hmm. But it wants to sound 90s-ish, or it wants to be like something that's Nirvana-like, or something that sounds like New Kids on the Block. And with TuneCore, you've got all bases covered because so many different types of artists and are distributing.
But in a way, it almost sounds like it's... It makes it even harder. How do you find exactly what's right? In amongst...
Right. There's a lot of genre coding we have.
Yeah, okay.
And they do a lot of listening. We do a lot of listening here.
I'd say you'd almost have to.
Yeah.
Kind of figure it out. It seems like... it doesn't seem like it. It is happening, where downloads are going away and we're becoming a streaming society here. How fast do you think that's going to happen? And where is there something beyond that that we don't know about yet?
I think that this is partially my business opinion, and this is partially my personal opinion. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to have several of us that just still love... The physical's not gone away.
No, it's still pretty...
It's there.
13 million or something.
It's still there, and it's not going to completely ever go away because there's always the audiophile group of people. And somebody could say to me, well, a teenager's not going to buy vinyl. I disagree. There's people that get into that thing.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, there's a new generation that would rather ride the subway or a bus than drive a car because then they can't be on their phone doing what they're doing, right?
Yeah.
So that's going to keep growing as the generations go, but I think that core is going to always stay there. There's a certain segment that always wants physical product, and it also, there are certain genres where the physical product is is important to those fans.
But downloads don't seem to be important to anybody right now.
No, because there's not that much of a difference between that and the stream if you're clicking the button on your phone, right?
Except it's not taking up storage.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's going to go up, but I think physical's never going to go away.
Have we bottomed out yet?
No. It's still. Yeah. It's still very, very, very prominent.
You know, the way I look at it is, okay, so there's 218.
Everybody's million. Looking for the shift in the story, and I think it's a very long, slow shift.
So there are 200 million CDs last year sold that we know about.
Right.
But there's all these other CDs that bands are selling at clubs, are selling on the website and everything that, you know, they're not in the stream. SoundScan doesn't know about them.
You go to South by Southwest, how many bands are pushing vinyl?
Yeah.
Most of them. How many are pushing physical product? Most of them.
Yeah.
And even all the way up to the major acts. I mean, Iron Maiden puts a new album out. I'm not going to download it. I'm going to buy it because I want all the artwork with the mascot, right?
Yeah, sure.
So it's it depends what kind of music it is, and it depends who the audience is. If it's a new hit single, and I'm a teenager and it's a hip hop thing, I'm most likely going to stream it.
And with the world going more towards streaming, how does that affect TuneCore Publishing?
Well, it's a very good thing for publishing.
I think the pie's going to get bigger eventually.
Yeah. It depends on how the laws change and how everything adapts. I really feel strongly that all those separate royalty types I've told you about are going to start becoming condensed into one. I really feel that breaking out the mechanical and the performance on the publishing, I have a funny feeling that that's going to turn into one right.
That'll make life a whole lot easier, huh?
It will simplify things, not only for us, but for the providers, for the stores themselves. You look at your Spotify and you got to break out all these different royalties on every single one of those clicks.
Yeah.
It makes things more complicated. And I think that's where you're going with it. And I think, again, that's why publishing that intellectual property of that composition is more valuable, because hundreds of sound recordings, like the Sinatra example I gave you, he did it, Elvis did it, Sid Vicious did it.
Yeah.
Well, the publisher gains on all three versions, not just the individual versions.
Sure.
Right? So that's why, and there's more revenue, types of revenue that are tied to that copyright. So there's, for publishing, I don't see anything dying. I see it going up and up and up, no matter what the format, because it always finds a way. It started from sheet music.
Yeah, right.
Right? And it found a way as things evolved, as things adapted. It just, the technology over the last 10, 11 years has accelerated at such a pace that the industry's catching back up to it. And the laws have to catch back up to it.
How soon do you think that'll happen?
I have no idea there. Yeah. But I do know this, if you do it right like we're doing, once you have the data is the key. And you use the data in the right way, and you send it to the right places, and you put the right, you know, you do it in the right sequence like we do, you're going to do well with it. And it's surprising. There's a lot of songwriters I've sent, collected $100,000 for.
Hmm.
A few, and a lot more that are in the, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. These are big numbers for composers, and who are also the artists, who this is money they did not know that was there.
Yeah, no kidding.
And immediate kickouts in Canada and Spotify with Rhapsody, and Australia and Japan and in Germany, lots. Especially the Anglo-American copyrights. When you get into Europe, they're a big seller there. In a lot of territories, it just depends, because the native music is obviously the most popular.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, in Canada, it's mandated too, right?
Yeah, a percentage of it, yeah. Yeah. They must listen to a lot of Russian Triumph up there, Brian Adams.
I would think, I would think. Well, and the other thing too is the government supports their arts, which is interesting. I mean, I always thought that was really admirable.
Yeah, and it needs a little bit more of that in the States, I believe.
Oh, no kidding. That'd be great. Is there a revenue source that everyone's missing?
It's really the mechanicals for downloads and streams. That's the one that it sits there, and if nobody comes to get it, if your composition's not registered at GAMA in Germany, or not registered at CMRA in Canada, or not registered at APRA AMCOS in Australia, after a while,
yeah,
you're out.
Yeah. And is there statute of limitations on that?
Yeah, in the different countries, they're going to do what they're going to do. They have different laws in each one. So the key thing here is get your compositions registered everywhere possible as soon as possible so you don't miss out. It's much more difficult to go back and get it. We can in cases, and we do in a lot of cases, but in some, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Are the PROs going to survive?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, as long as there's, there's such huge, there's so many places for them to go. We need them. There's no way we could, do what they do. We can't monitor thousands of radio stations, thousands of TV stations, and get playlists from them, right?
Yeah.
The place that they're going to have to, I think, eventually let go of are these digital, the Pandoras of the world, the Netflix of the world, the YouTubes of the world. I think that's where they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
In my personal opinion, because they're doing blanket licenses, and this is something with, we know how many times somebody clicked the YouTube button. We know how many times somebody streamed it in Spotify.
Right, there's no point ever.
And I've got a count of streaming mechanicals on Spotify for a particular composition. I want that equivalent account from the PRO.
Yeah, right.
And that's where I think they didn't keep up. I like them. I'm a big advocate of them. We at TuneCore think they're necessary. We need to have them there. We can't cover jukeboxes. We can't cover radio stations and television stations and all the cable channels and all the different regions and all those things. Or the live performance
thing,
which is very important. So I'm a big advocate of them. I want them to survive. I want them to be there. But I really think that they need to roll with the times as far as some of the... I think they haven't developed with that. And I think it blindsided them. And I'm hoping that in their boardrooms and in their back rooms that they're pushing to update their systems to accommodate this stuff.
Yeah. Last question. What's the best piece of business advice that you've ever either been given or you've learned along the way?
In regards to publishing?
Music business?
Street smarts. Getting the money is about street smarts. I've had employees, contacts, people go through college, people go through this thing at music business school here, there, and there. And when they get here, I got to teach them how to be street smart. It's all the sequence of events. What's the other party going to do to not have to pay you? Right?
Yeah, right.
What are they going to do? What are they going to use as an excuse not to cut the check that you're trying to get for the composer that you represent?
Yeah.
If you don't send them your tax information, if you don't send them a letter of direction first, if you don't send this signed and that signed, crossing your T's and dotting all your I's and eliminating any way for them to get out of paying you. And it's all street smarts. It has not, a professor can tell you about it. Somebody can write a book about publishing, tell you all the in and outs. I can throw all these funky terminologies of what's this and what's that at you all day and night. Bottom line is, you got to outsmart the sources in a way that gets the, and they're not all out to, let me make this clear, they're not all out to rip you off.
Well, they're doing best for their clients as well. Yeah.
Well, they're doing the best for their clients, but they have basically things in place at these different organizations, whether it's a record label or a streaming service or a society, that they can only do things based on the systems they have.
Yeah, right.
And you have to think about, okay, what are they doing over there? How do they do it? What's, okay, what's the best way to make it easier for them so I can pay the composer, to pay the writer?
Yeah.
So you got to be street about it. It's very much, you don't try to take the tire, jack the car up without loosening the lug nuts first, right? That same kind of thing. How do we loosen the lug nuts first on this?
Yeah.
Boom. Okay, now we jack the car up. Now we got the new tire on. We got them paid. That's the trick.
I love it.
And that's the best part of it.
That's great. Thank you, Jamie. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Jamie's also a heck of a guitar player and a songwriter. And you can hear him at interstateblues.com, which is the name of his band, interstateblues.com. And you can also go to TuneCore Publishing to find out more about him. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyointercircle.com, questions@bobbyointercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the Producer Podcast at theproducer.club.club. He helps put this together. He does a great job. Thank you, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyointercircle.com, or you can find us on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I'll see you next time.